Yes, you're listening to Basgasten, a podcast in which I, Hidden Roda, interview national and international bass players about their career, their gear, and their influences. And on this episode of Basgasten, you'll be hearing my interview that I had with Jeff Berlin, a legendary fusion bass player known for playing with Bill Bruford, Alan Holdsworth, Scott Henderson, and many, many others. And I interviewed him prior to his clinic he did in Q Factory Amsterdam. Basgasten is powered by Dubassist, the bass magazine for Holland and Belgium.
That was the boss.
Well, Jeff, thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are in Amsterdam at the Q Factory where you're going to do a clinic tonight.
Yes, sir.
Especially for bass players, I presume.
For bass players, and I'm fortunate. I get guitar players, keyboardists, drummers too, because the general lessons or the things I share also apply to other instruments.
So right. So it's more about music in general than about being a bassist and how to maneuver yourself in a band or whatever.
Yeah, I rarely, if ever, discuss how to play in a band.
Right.
Only because before it became a topic of discussion, every single musician figured it out. So it's such an obvious thing to anybody who will just take the time to play that I chose not to charge people money to be taught something that I know for a fact everyone can learn for free if they give them the time.
Yeah.
So in that...
Just figure it out while playing in different groups and...
Yeah, I mean, that's... Part of the, yes, exactly. Playing is itself its own skill, its own school, its own approach. But in the clinics, I'll teach 75% to bass players and 25% or 10 or 15% relate to other instruments.
Right.
But I relate mostly to music and the learning of it. So
great. So I'm going to really start with the same question I'm asking every guest on my podcast.
Sure, sure.
Which is, which bass are you playing?
I'm fortunate. I have a very simple need for basses. I like passive basses, sort of, and maybe a hangover for the fact that I've never been personally. It's a personal taste.
Of course.
I'm not fond of tweeters. I'm not fond of active basses.
Yeah.
Because I know if I adjust my amp and adjust my bass, I'll get a roaring good high-end sound.
Yeah.
And to me, it sounds more, it's funny as it may sound, an acoustic version of an electric sound.
Yeah.
When you hit tweeters, to me, it's an artificial adding of a signal, and the active sort of boosts a high-end that, for me, isn't quite what I like. So the bass I have is a Cort Rhythmic. And Cort has been expanding its market and becoming more of a world player alongside of the other big names. And they built this bass, and it's, to me, the best, this line is the best passive bass for me since the 1962 Fender Jazz bass.
Wow.
The tone, we were playing earlier, and you noticed how even and how great the tone is. It's alder wood, which is tabletop wood. All old Fenders are made with alder, most of them. They're passive Bartolinis, but this Bartolini set is only wound for this line. You can't get this pickup anywhere else.
Okay.
I use a Jeff Babix, a Babix bass bridge, which to me is the greatest bridge innovation
in music.
They're
great bridges, yeah.
And that's it. It's fairly simple. The beauty of it is it's sustain. It's natural.
Yeah.
Sustain.
It's an ebony fretboard, right? And apart from the alder body, it has a special top woods. Is it something you picked out yourself, or does it have what made you choose these woods? Because I see it as spotted maple, probably, and then it's walnut or koa.
It's a spotted maple and an orange Padauk. Laminate, because I've always played plain, normal, sort of non-interesting looking basses.
Right.
That aesthetic, again, wasn't pleasing to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got with Cort, I said, I'm going to do something new. Let's go all the way. So my wife designed this. She said, why don't you do, instead of this and this and this, how about one side? And that's a quick drawing. She sent it to them, and that's what they produce.
Wow.
And I, again, I... am not just saying this. I've never played a better four-string passive bass in my life.
It looks amazing.
It looks amazing. And yeah, through two of these guys, it's a train.
Yeah, because apart from this bass that was designed by and for you, you also have your signature line of Mark Bass amplifiers,
mm-hmm.
which, as you mentioned before, do not have tweeters in them.
No.
But they do have a 15-inch driver, and I think many bass players would say, okay, so you have a 15-inch driver, you need a tweeter in this amp, because the 15-inch cannot like project the high frequencies that you need on a big stage. So what was your choice leaving out the tweeter in this amp?
Well, because I know that 15s can produce the highs. I think that when people decide to experiment further and discover the actual full range capacity of a 15-inch speaker, they might become surprised. This can produce a lot of highs, an incredible amount of highs. I mean, I could demonstrate it, but I'm not doing a sales job here.
Of course.
But 15s produce great highs. You just have to examine it. Adjusting the tone on the bass and getting and working with the speakers, you'll get what I call acoustic electronic.
Yeah, so as pure as possible and as less tweak, less like artificially tweaking as possible through an active preamp or a tweeter or a very extensive equalizing or those kind of things.
Yes, and I'm fortunate because this is like a sound, it's just pure and simple for me. But I do recognize, and of course, people should choose what they want to make them happy. That's the choice of music, amps, toys, basses, art, strings, and you know, people have to choose. I would just encourage them if they checked out a 15 without a tweeter and just give it a couple of more days and try things, they might be surprised on what they could find in a 15-inch speaker, you know.
As you mentioned, this is for you the best bass, the best passive four string since the 1962 jazz bass.
For me, in my opinion.
You've been around for a while. Can you still remember the first time you heard a bass and you went, this is the instrument I want to play? The first time you were like grabbed by this low end four string instrument that we both use.
Yes. I can. I can't remember the day, the moment of the song, but I remember the group and I remember the bass player, which was Cream, and the bassist was Jack Bruce. And I listened to Beatle records early, and then expanded from there with the bands of the 60s.
Right.
But Cream was unique amongst all of them because it was a playing band. And you know how you find out early what one is prepared to do in life. What one is, so what the stars have consigned to you. When I heard Cream in those jams, that's where it hit me right where I live. I wanted to be a player.
So what do you mean by a playing band? Exactly. Do you mean their compositions are relatively simple and then they had like long jams on stage? Is that the kind of thing that I have to think about when you say a player band?
Essentially, bands that play, that jam, that interact, that in a funny way, it was almost a jazz group because jazz plays dun dun da 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 da. Then you solo, he solo, she solo, I solo, and then the band goes out. Dun, dun, da, 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 and that's sort of the thing. That's what Cream did. You know, they did that. Then I'm so glad, I'm glad, I'm glad, I'm glad, I'm glad. 2, 3, 4.
Right.
And they were off jamming. And that's a player's band. Their whole success at that particular time, what literally got them to sell practically 35 million records was at that time there was an audience that was excited by players.
Yeah.
I don't think we have that anymore to the degree where playing is exciting. But at that time, I was fortunate I came along when that was exciting. And Cream, Jack Bruce, to this minute, to this day, he's my favorite bassist from that particular period. He had a lifetime of history of music.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that just sent me off to the moon, man.
Which is one of the reasons why you're working on a Jack Bruce album at the moment.
It's exactly correct. I'm doing a Jack Bruce retrospective in memory of my late friend, because I was friends with him. And I took his songs. It's not a Cream retrospective.
Right.
It's a Jack Bruce. So I took a bunch of his songs and rearranged them in ways that I'm really happy about. I actually took Cream and put in one Cream song 7 of his Cream compositions, and it works.
Oh, wow.
It's a fascinating arrangement that I did because I'm not fond of covers.
No.
It's a personal thing. I didn't want to go dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
Because it's been done.
It happened, yeah.
So I did something rather different, but it still retains the 4-4, still retains the rock energy. I got lucky. I got Alex Lifeson is a pal of mine from Rush, and he played the solo.
Oh, wow.
And it's a rocking song, and I'm not playing. You know, there's no jazz there at all.
You pay tribute to the Cream sound.
And
playing with Alex Lifeson, of course, he's a rocking guitar player.
Yes, sir.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So, do you remember what your first bass was? The first one you ever got? A Hagstrom. Never heard that one before.
I got a Hagstrom because the bass player in my high school, Seth Kimball, who played for years with Louis Prima in Vegas.
Oh, really?
Had a Hagstrom. He had a Hagstrom.
I got a Hagstrom. Do you still have it?
No.
Too bad. No. And so you got into bass playing through the classic rock of the 60s, like the Beatles and Cream, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the first instrument you picked up? I read a bit into you, and I read you started out on violin when you were younger.
I was 5 years old, and I was given a violin, and I was a serious student till I was about 16. I was an orchestra violinist. I mean, small orchestras. This wasn't the New York Phil.
Right.
I played in orchestras, I played in recitals, I played in quartets, I was concert master of youth orchestras. I was a good and serious violinist, and it helped prepare me to understand what it takes in order to learn. And then when the Beatles came along, I entered into the self-taught approach, and that helped me to investigate. So I had both academic training, according to the rules of music, not what I wanted, not what I predicted, but what I was told had to have been done, and lucky for me, they told me. And then I had the other way, which is the self-investigative manner, which never doesn't have any limits. There's nothing. If anyone wants to do anything, that's how you should do it, because that's what self-taught is all about.
So, and do you have the feeling that the basis you got when being trained as a classical musician, do you still use that to this day, like when you're studying or teaching? How much of that classical training do you still incorporate in when you're teaching or giving a clinic tonight?
The training is constant, because I noticed that the training that I received in music is precisely the training that a law student, medical student, truck driver in a vocational school received. It's the kind of training you engaged in when you first learned how to drive. There's a factual regard of the law and the rules of driving. Once you drive, you can take a left, you can take a right, you can be sort of flowing with it, but the training element was not broad, because I don't believe broad is a helpful way for bass players to be taught. We can explain it.
Love to hear more about what you mean by that.
Sure. But learning as self-taught has no rules. Being taught is entirely engaged, and especially being taught for a check. Here's money, fix my car. You're not going to do it in a broad and spectacular and inventive and creative manner. Just fix it. I'd like to have dinner. Here's money. Give me a nice plate of spaghetti. It's, you know, I'm not going to hold the spaghetti over steam and then, you know, I don't know what to say. Or the steam method of cooking.
Right. You just make a plate of spaghetti.
You just make a plate of spaghetti to the best of your ability and the way you were trained. Usually these guys are taught chefs, you know.
Correct.
So that's all I really meant to say in that, is that my violin training got me to where I could take anybody, and I really believe that it could be anybody, and make them a better bass player in an hour. Now, better as a bass player, let me just do some. This wasn't planned, but better as a bass player in an hour could simply mean that much more thickness of that.
Yeah.
Improvement. But that is still improvement.
That is still improvement, yeah.
Here's the next lesson. Here's the next lesson. Here's month one. Here's month two. Here's month three. And it's after 3 or 4 months that the distinct improvement of musicians becomes evident. And that's what being taught correctly will give anybody.
And do you notice a change in the expectations of students over the years? I mean, I'm a bass teacher myself, and I noticed that many students want to go the whole book in a couple of weeks, because, you know, they see everybody playing guitar on the internet and go like, oh, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then want to go like play the stuff they know within a few weeks and go, yeah, I want to be like Flea in 3 weeks' time, oh, I want to play this, I want to play that. Do you notice a change in the expectations of students over the years?
Yeah, I certainly have. I've noticed two things, that students have changed in their wish or the manner that they wish to be taught, and I also noticed that teachers are more than happy to accommodate them. And I noticed this as a worldwide phenomenon, whereby it used to be, and it still is in the classical genre, that an upright or an oboe student won't go in and say, you know, I want to play oboe like that guy played oboe on the right. on the what record or this or that, or I want to play the violin like he did on Schindler's List, you know. Rather, in this genre, in complete genre, students walk in and the teacher is entirely responsible for a guiding improvement of their playing. And you know something? They all get better. Bass players, and I'm sorry to say this, don't get better. And I'm also sorry to say they're not going to get better. And the reason that this is because, and it isn't my rules, I can't get better at speaking Dutch, no matter how I wish it and no matter how I think about it, until I learn what the words are.
Right.
And that, sir, is the end of the story of the lesson of learning a language. You learn its words. Now, you can learn its words being self-taught, which pretty much makes you or I or whomever the responsible teacher. But what do I know about teaching myself Dutch?
Right.
I need a teacher to teach me Dutch.
You teach you the rules and the pronunciation and grammar and whatever.
Sure. So when a bass student says, well, I want to do this or want to do that, I'm usually apt to say, well, why don't you not do that and do that being self-taught? Because I have an interesting question for you and actually for everybody who's watching this is, can they name anybody who was taught rock in school that's a famous rock guitarist or rock drummer?
Wow. That's a very good question.
I mean, Steve Vai certainly went to Berkeley, so did Stu Hamm, but they didn't learn rock there.
No.
And since there's a lot of rock education and kids wish to learn rock, or younger people, everyone, I want to learn this line. I want to learn how to slap.
Right.
I think this is fair. But the ironic thing is, I submit that almost nobody can name anybody who's successful in rock who was ever taught rock in a school to where they were right. successful at it. And what that simply means is that rock education has failed in its promise to provide even as simple a result as a driving school will produce.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. We have a couple of rock education, rock conservatories here in Holland, and there are a couple of bands that are really big in like Europe who have finished, who have graduated that school as being a rock musician. There's even a school called the Rock Academy. And I think it only started about 15 years ago when I went to conservatory. It was in 2007. It was starting out. It was starting up for a few years. But I think the musicians that graduate those schools now are really amazing musicians. But that's mostly, I think, because they're being taught how to be a musician and how to be a professional. And then
how do you refer? I ought to ask you something. You mentioned a couple of bands that were successful out of the school.
Yeah.
How many students did the school graduate?
I think about 25 per school per year. So that's about, I don't know how many there are in Holland, but.
Well, you can do the math and notice that for the most part, rock students are not going to gain that success.
But isn't that also true for jazz-taught musicians?
Jazz-taught musicians are taught music and not taught to succeed in music. Jazz musicians and classical musicians are not prepared for careers, meaning if you do this, you'll get the symphony gig. If you learn jazz, you'll get the jazz gig.
Yeah.
But today, bass players, in fact, almost entirely talk about getting the gig, on the gig I played with this band, on the show, on, you know, it's an entire focus. When the truth is that a school really shouldn't prepare people, in my opinion, for careers. They should prepare people to learn how to play better. And the side benefit of playing better is to get a career. So if you mentioned a couple of bands out of the school, I won't name any other schools, but there's a couple of schools that name their famous alumni, two or three or four guys or bands. And that is not a good statistic as compared to the overwhelming number of law students who are guaranteed by the dint of their qualifications, they're going to be teaching they're going to be practicing law. So I don't find rock music by the dint of two successes as a successful educational art form. And further, I submit that these guys could have learned exactly what they learned had they been self-taught anyways, or more or less. So you're spending money, quite a number of thousands of dollars, to play or be taught a music that the history shows before the schools that everybody succeeded in for free. And not only succeeded in it, succeeded better than had they gone to school. And I'll tell you why I think so. Because a lot of guys talk about being finding a style or finding my own way.
Yeah, finding their own sound and their own voice.
Your own voice. You can't find it in music school because that's not what music school is for. So let's say slap, you know. People, I'm not a good slapper. People might want to realize that if they pay to go to study slap, that practically the entirety of the entire slap bass teacher community are self-taught.
Yeah, especially like I think mainly the generation like before me, I'm almost 30, and all my teachers were self-taught, but I think the amount of teachers that were taught in schools to play slap or play bass or whatever, I think it's the amount is rising, and I also think it's not only a responsibility to make you the best bass player or guitar player or drummer you can be, but also be a good musician, and that's I think what
defines a good musician.
Well, to be a professional, to be prepared.
What defines you to be a professional?
To be prepared at your gig, to be on time, to have your gear in order, and to be a reliable person. Like you're healthy, you don't abuse stuff, whatever.
Now I have a question. Do you really want to pay a school tuition to be told to be on time and be healthy and to have good amps?
You can also, of course you can be self-taught in that.
I think everybody has been. I think that for 99, and you can decide if you agree or not, but practically the entirety of all the capable professionals in the world have got it in their mind, as all the doctors and policemen and teachers, that you got to show up on time. I think that people understand that they want to have good gear, certainly, and learn to make a good tone, and find it a little ironic that people feel like they have to pay someone to tell them something that, to me, is relatively obvious.
Of course.
And the third thing is that to be a good person is a little bit of a redundancy that a bass teacher would take it upon himself to determine to an adult student body that you have to be good people, when the truth is one's parents, one's minister, a pastor, a rabbi, one's guru, one's wife or husband, the loved ones, are the ones that cultivated a child to become a good person. So here I am, 23 years old, and I would kind of wonder that, is it appropriate for a bass teacher whose job it is to teach me how to play this instrument, is actually the one that seems to take it on himself that I need to know or hear that I have to be a good person as well. I find that a bit insulting in its sort of, you know, so that's why I'm not popular among a lot of people, because I say these things. Most everyone I know, I bet most everyone you know, are great people.
Yeah.
Sure, they're great guys. Look who's sitting over here, sitting on the floor, Alex. He's a great guy. We said hello, aren't, you know, guys out there, guys at my clinic. I know everyone that's a great guy, and communication is dead easy. Let me tell you how I feel. I mean, I don't, it's an invention of the bass community to have added these principles when the single one element that is most necessary, which is the teaching and the playing of a bass, is the one thing that most bass teachers seem to lack.
But wouldn't that mean that teaching a style as a bass teacher is obsolete anyway, because you just have to be a better bass player?
What do you mean style?
So you have these jazz colleges and rock educations, and isn't it then better to just make it bass education in general?
Well, music education, factual reading and factual reading of music, etudes, and harmonically significant music. Here's an interesting thought. What do you think the very first reason that a bass was built to provide? It's not a loaded question, but it's
I'm struggling to understand what you're trying to ask.
What do you think that this, here's a bass.
Yeah.
The very, excuse me, what is the very, very first thing that a bass was built for to provide, to offer?
A bass guitar? Or,
yeah, bass guitar.
To make a double bass more portable and easier to carry around.
Could be. But what about the very first musical principle? What is the first musical?
To provide a low end to music, probably. And make provide a foundation and interlocking with the drummer.
Okay. Now, what if the band has music that doesn't have interlocking drummer bass parts? And what if the bass part is up on the neck and not a foundation?
Hmm.
So there's even an earlier principle. I'll give you the answer. The very first thing, and I don't believe anyone's thought of this, the very first thing a bass was built for was to provide a note.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. That's
as simple as that.
The very first principle. In fact, it's so obvious you can see it.
Yeah.
You know, this part supports that portion.
Yeah.
But the first thing was to provide...
Why is it built? Yeah.
To build, to provide a note. And it's a fun question. And it's obvious and it's irrefutable. So the point is that if the very first principle is to provide a note and subsequent usages of it are to provide notes, then it makes sense that the thing that a bass teacher is responsible the most to teach are what those notes are.
Yeah.
And to me... That's where bass teachers have deviated, because music is not at the forefront anymore. Groove isn't first in music, it's last. I'm not sure if you knew that.
It depends on who you ask.
I
was at a masterclass of, God, was it Justin? He's a New York musician, and he was talking about jazz music, and he said, he was talking about soloing in jazz, and he says, jazz musicians, they never play melody. They always play a rhythm and put notes to it. So he said rhythm and groove is the first thing that jazz musicians worry about, and then about pitch, tonality, harmony, all those other things.
Name a song you know, the melody that you've never played on a bass, a Christmas song or a...
Oh, that's a good one. I think I've never ever played We Wish You a Merry Christmas before.
Play it on the bass, the melody.
See if I can play it without any errors.
Now stop. I'll tell you what got in your way. You don't know what the notes are on the neck. So the first thing that happened is the groove was completely unavailable. Now I'm doing this for everybody to watch. Play it again and slow it down 50%.
Yeah, well, while I was playing, I was going, this is a bit too quick.
Play it 50%. And now I notice you're looking up at God. Look down at your neck. Now relax. I also see this. Take it 100% with less tension. Meaning if I was going to, because I never played it either.
Right.
I would suggest not this, but what I suggest is... Figure the notes out.
Yeah.
I want to tell you something in Dutch.
Yeah, right.
I want to tell you something in Dutch. Well, Jeff, just think of the words. Now play the melody. Play the melody. But do it gently. Look who played it perfectly, and look who played it in time perfectly.
Right.
Now do it again, about a little faster, maybe same tempo, and make it a little funkier if you want to. Find a groove. Just it. Now do it again, and it's still kind of choppy. I'm doing this on purpose for your viewers. Do it one more time and play it less choppy, but still a little interesting. Now, I'll tell you something. Groove that you demonstrated was last.
Yeah.
The first thing was notes.
Yeah.
It's always like that in music. And I was so certain of it that I wanted to invite you to demonstrate this for the good of these people. that groove forever and ever is going to be the last issue that people have to deal with until they learn what the notes are. And once you've learned the notes, wait, hold on.
Right.
Oh, let me slow this way down.
It's funny what you demonstrate now that I played it in one position,
mm-hmm.
and I think you played it in three or maybe four. But so that's just that's knowing your neck and know where you are and where your scales and stuff are. Are you? I don't know if you still practice a lot when you're playing bass now.
Not much lately, but I have for years.
But yeah. So when you're practicing, do you have a standard routine? Are you a practicer of scales, or do you practice melodies in your head, or what's your approach to practicing and knowing the notes on your instrument? Is there a standard thing that you teach every, like a trick of some sorts? I know there's no tricks, but yeah, is there a routine?
Yes. Read music. Practice at a time and put away the metronome. Because when people are this is the priority. The notes aren't.
Yeah.
But when people, the reason I can get up and down my neck is because for many years I've practiced over time, like that one page, the next
right.
page. My musical life might now be in the academic this because of violin and everything else.
Yeah.
So scales are very overrated. Scales don't get you to play better, just like modes don't get you to play better. Scales and modes are a technical, harmonic reality of music. You learn them in a week or 2 weeks, or you keep on in certain ways, and then you move on to the next things.
Right.
So I don't practice scales, but I'll tell you one thing if you want to do it. Do you play chord tones?
Yeah, I do.
Do you know a blues, like a B-flat blues?
I do.
Let's play a B-flat. You want to do this for the guys?
Sure.
Do a B-flat blues. First, I won't go into the walking part because that's a whole other sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know what the B-flat 7 chord tones are?
Of course, yeah.
Can you play me? Beautiful. Can you play the whole blues only on chord tones? E-flat 7
yeah.
chord tones?
Yeah, B-flat. Yeah, of course.
Try
and then play the simple 12-bar 1-4-5 blues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1, a 2, a 1, a 2, 3... go. Now
there's a fourth mode there. Yeah, of course.
The
E flat.
So we'll do the and yep. also you're walking now.
Yeah.
And you don't want to play the fourth. This is hard, and I'm doing this for a reason. Try to play eighth notes.
Okay. Yeah.
If you can, take a little
sure.
breaks. I'll do it slower.
Yep.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay. Yeah, of course,
that's just a mistake.
Yeah,
that's just a mistake. Do the E diminished.
It's been a while.
3, 4, E diminished. All right, what are the chord tones for E diminished? And this is where the notes comes into play.
Yeah.
You're not a bad bass player. I'm giving you something that maybe isn't
yeah.
familiar at the juncture.
It's been a while since I play. Of course, I play jazz music and play walking bass, but it's been a while since I went back to. You know, just playing chord tones.
Okay.
Know what I mean. So it's been
okay.
a while.
Play E diminished. Sure. 3, 4.
Ah.
E flat 7, B flat 7, B flat 7. G7. And with the occasional missed note,
course,
because
yeah.
you're in a lesson, you're not supposed to play it perfectly.
Of course.
You're allowed and encouraged to make those bumps. Now, if I had you play this in 12 keys, you'd be dealing in specific harmony for 12 keys. So a lot
yeah.
of guys can't play this. It's rare that I can get somebody to play just... because they're always wanting to.
Yeah.
And it's.
By embellishments and.
Because people want to, and reasonably, to make art.
Yeah.
They want that. But in a lesson, it's not art. Art and music, excuse me. Art and practicing, playing and learning are antithetical to each other.
Yeah.
That's why I don't like people to be taught how to play rock or taught how to play thumb, which, as I say, most all teachers are self-taught. And because it is such a proven road before that all the slappers and all just about all the rockers just about all the blues players just about all everybody two-handed tappers just about are all self-taught in the genre, I have a feeling that a lot of guys are losing out because they're not self-taught and are willing to sound bad. You have to be willing to sound bad, even in the situation of you're making a couple of mistakes on camera, trust me. In fact, people that have seen my stuff know that I leave my mistakes in.
Yeah.
I'll do a thing. Oh, mistake.
Yeah.
I don't edit that out.
That's also a thing that's I think has changed over the years with people, with expectations of people, because they see stuff on the internet and presume that it's a one take or it's without editing or whatever. And they're like, wow, that's perfect. That's what I want to do. And when I'm teaching in high school, which I do, I always spend a couple of lessons about mistakes on records and go, this is what musicians do. They make mistakes and it's fine. Leave it in. And so it's with auto-tuning vocals and whatever. Do you see that as a thing that's happening? Like when people are expecting you to play perfect now in comparison to, let's say, 25 years ago?
Well, no, but I will refer to your saying to guys to leave mistakes in, because even here you're teaching guys how to perform, and it might be a good idea to teach them how to play. It's just a suggestion that look at the record. They leave a mistake in, so maybe you should leave a mistake.
Yeah, well, that's in the context of these guys can play, and even they make mistakes, so do your best, but I mean, it's fine if you make a mistake.
Yeah, I like the encouragement. I think that's a great idea, actually. Because I've seen guys just get a little like this, literally.
And they stop playing when they make, like I did a couple of minutes ago.
Well, can I be honest? You're supposed to stop playing when you make a mistake. It's required.
When practicing.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You have to stop.
It's like of course. And analyze what the mistake was.
Oh, well, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
You got it. So the slower one learns, the faster one plays. And the more
one repeats.
That's, you know, I'm not trying to tell people how to play or how to practice. I'm trying to tell people what'll happen if they do what they do. And in what I like about this is that I can prove my points is that my wish. See, every teacher is a great guy. I've never met a bad bass teacher. Never. I've never have.
I have once.
Okay.
But
you're one up on me. I mean, every bass teacher I've ever met seems to be a lovely guy. Lovely girl. Great bass players, most of them. They're all terrific people, terrific bass players. The one line that I draw that people sometimes have a hard time seeing in me with me is that qualification to teach is way different than the kind of person you are and the kind of bass player you are.
Yeah.
So when I criticize, let's say, some of the top teachers or schools, I'm not naming them. I'm not saying that blah, blah school in Amsterdam or the blah, blah school in Pittsburgh or whatever it is or so-and-so and such and such. I'm saying quite specifically that if bass teachers don't teach you music, as has always been taught for centuries and has 100% proof of working, you're not going to get better.
No.
You'll just be happy. You'll be entertained, but you're not going to play better. And I'm saying is that it's not awful to learn how to play better. It's easy. I could take Alex, who's never played a note in his life, right? You never played, right?
Well, I've played a note, but...
You played a note?
Wow.
Yeah. I'll teach him a note he never played. And, see, that's what it is. Learning is easy, but you have to teach music, and it's the one thing bass players shy away from. So I'd like to see that change.
Cool. I want to talk about music in general a little bit, and also about I was listening to a couple of your records in preparation for this interview, and I was listening to Bruford Records, and And I heard you playing fretless bass on those on a couple of those tracks.
Right.
If I heard correctly.
You might have, because I did play it for a few months. Yes,
and,
I did.
I just don't recall
someone else asked that too.
You came to the scene in the 70s and 80s, mainly in the early 80s.
70s.
70s and 80s. During a time where playing like solos on a bass guitar was getting more and more popular.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, of course, a couple of major other bass players in that period, like Jaco Pastorius and stuff. Did you find that when people called you for a gig, they were going, can you play a solo like Jaco did? Or like Jaco would play? How do you see that the popularity of especially Jaco, because I'm a big Jaco Pastorius fan, mm-hmm. as I hope are many bass players. How do you see his influence on the scene you were in at that time?
He was the greatest bass player that ever lived, the most influential bass player, the only real bona fide genius out of all of us. It was just a wonderful DNA lineup. His writing, his vision, his whole thing, it's unparalleled. So in that regard, no one asked me to play like him, but that thing was popular. And I was an ex-violinist, so I enjoyed seeking those things. But
yeah.
I'll tell you straight, and I'll say it forever, I was never a good bass player in those days. I was a hyper kid playing a million notes without any real purpose. I had to learn and grow because I didn't have genius. I didn't have a style. I just knew I wanted something. I didn't know what.
Yeah.
So that's why when I go on about my educational things, I know what I'm talking about, because what happened to me applies to almost everybody. And but Jaco was the greatest of us all. There's just no doubt about it.
And I'm a big advocate in my own work for playing fretless. I wanted to bring my fretless bass on almost every session I do, and I take it along to every new band I'm in as well.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the position of, well, maybe a bass player in general, but also especially the fretless bass in, let's say, popular music these days? I have the feeling that it has declined. I know very few bass players who would bring a fretless along, and very few bands or singers who would ask you to play fretless or a part that could have been on a fretless bass. How do you view that development? I mean, there was a big rush in the 80s with Pino Palladino playing fretless on basically everybody's records.
Well, I mean, it's an artistic choice. I generally have no comment about art and the progress of music, how one plays, what one plays, because mm-hmm. it's personal. My general feeling, though, is this. Pino became a fretless player, I feel, because of Jaco. And he's such a good bass player anyway.
Yeah.
But that sound, there's an interesting thing that came up in my mind some years ago, and I'll ask the question. Can you think of one pianist that defined the piano sound?
Glenn Gould.
He didn't define it. He played piano.
That's true, but he defined a way of playing piano.
He has a way of playing the piano.
Yeah.
So, but even, again, more to the left.
Yeah.
Can you think of any pianist that defined the piano sound? You hear a piano, you think this person, the tone, the sound, the touch.
Chick Corea. I can hear him on any record.
He has a sound and a style.
Yeah.
Is he the singular defining person of the piano?
No.
Okay,
I don't think
my
that person
question.
Is. Oh, yeah, that's what you mean, like one person. Mm-hmm. No.
There isn't any. It's an interesting question, and it's okay. You did right to try to seek it out.
Yeah.
There's not one pianist that can say that person defined the piano. How about electric fretted bass? The one person that defined the whole instrument by its tone.
I don't think that person exists.
I agree. Not it doesn't exist.
No.
Neither does it on oboe, trumpet, piano, guitar. Now, if I ask who defined the sound of the fretless bass?
Yeah, that was Jaco.
Correct.
Definitely.
Now, here's the reason why I bring it up. He came along and presented something that simply, even though the instrument was around, he came along and presented something that simply didn't exist.
Right.
In the manner he did it. And for that reason, I was attracted to and then said no more. I did 2-3 months and recognized I got to get back to frets. But I did go there. The thing is that Jaco's sound is so definable and so instantaneous that to this day, I can't honestly say for me, now I'm just speaking personally, mm-hmm. I haven't heard anyone ever play where the first thing I hear is, You know, that thing.
Yeah.
There's a thing bass players do to this day. What do they do?
Yeah, of course.
You won't, personally, I won't do it because it's a defined, created, it's almost as if the thing is patented. And I feel that if musicians wish to be original or define to be original, and this is my philosophy, which is open for debate. Mm. I'm not saying I'm right here. I'm saying in this case, my feeling is I don't want to encroach on another man's style, woman's style.
Isn't that also an expectation thing? I mean, when people outside of bass playing think of fretless, they think of the Jaco sound.
Yes.
And when they ask you to play fretless, they go, yeah, but doesn't sound fretless. And then you take out your Jaco sound. And I own a fretless jazz bass on which I only use the bridge pickup, and I really like that sound. And when you go, they go, yeah, that's what I want to hear. Is it also not just an expectation?
Do you thing? Do records and do this?
I do.
This line and this sound.
Not that
so
this
what are you
line,
transferring on the records exactly?
In what sense?
The fretless thing that you were just playing. What do you play that you feel is the Jaco thing that you providing?
I do play the... I don't use a lot of harmonics when playing fretless, but I do use the... he has this thing where some fretless players will go... But Jaco did...
So do you?
I do.
You do. All right. Then I have two things to say. One, you're entitled, and any producer that asks you is within their right.
Right.
And it's my position is absolutely debatable and open to interpretation. I'm simply speaking as a guy who recognizes. It actually comes from something that Keith Jarrett and Miles Davis had between them. Keith Jarrett, this is a true story. Miles was famous for playing ballads.
Yeah.
And one day he stopped. He did this. This is a true story. And Keith Jarrett asked him, he said, why'd you stop playing ballads? And Miles answered, I quit playing ballads because I love to play ballads so much.
Right.
Now, that is an interesting bit of philosophy. And the answer would be, is like, you don't want to lose money and you don't want to lose work. But in my particular situation, if I wish to create something that might be identified with me, might not, who knows. It's not that I get it. It's that I seek it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would have to stop doing this. I'd have to stop doing or something.
Right.
I would have to deny myself several areas and look at this bare bones instrument and then take the next year to find something that no one else has done. And I found several things. I found a lot of things. I found ways to... You know, it's almost a Hawaiian thing. It's a minor little thing. Nobody does that.
Right.
I've done like, you know... You know, that's mine. I've done...
Yeah.
You know, and I have a bunch of these things.
So basically what you're saying is that you heard the Jaco stuff and basically of there's not anybody who's as I think there you're right that Jaco's probably the most influential bass player that's ever lived and probably ever will.
That I would never say.
Would never but I mean yeah. Anyway,
however, I appreciate your thought about it.
Yeah, what was it saying? Oh yeah. So your thought was okay. This is what Jaco does, but I'm not going there because that's his thing.
Yeah.
And you were going okay. He has something that's his. So now I'm going to find something that's mine.
Yeah, and it was based in part out of musical need, definitely part of human insecurity because I went to therapy some years later, and we insecure, afraid guys seek a. You know, love and appreciation. So we'll do things that'll get it for us. So that fear in me spurned me on a deep practice and deep learning, so that people would love me. And I'm not shy about admitting it because now that that's completely changed in me, after all the work I've done and the practicing, yeah. I've never been freer to be more creative as a bass player in my entire life. That's the reward of it. So Jaco was the most influential guy. But if I think if anybody wants and they refer to themselves as having something original or new, I tend to doubt it.
Yeah.
I think that if I'm going to hear something original and new, it's going to be so obvious that it's simply a galvanizing event, even if it's local or regional. So to do that, you have to be in denial of what the things you love. You know, it took me years to come up with a passive four string and a Mark Bass 15. It took me years. It took me years to go through equipment to finally arrive to where I'm home. And it was a painful, at times, transition, playing not in a way I liked, playing on instruments I wasn't 100% happy with, playing music I wasn't there. I mean, it was a kind of a climbing up of a rope with bare hands. And it's an interesting thing when you feel you finally get to a place where you think you're happy about it. But people could do this. They don't have to be fanatical like me. May I go back to the reading and write and practicing music? If they did this, they don't have to stop rocking out that evening. They don't have to deny themselves one thing that they love. Nothing. Zero. Rock out, slap out, play out, use your toys, use your equipment. Only add during the day.
Right. Yeah, I'd never think about your practicing and your technique while doing gigs. And
well, I don't.
I never do that.
Okay, that's your personal.
I think if I would start thinking about what I'm playing and how I'm playing it during a gig, I would lose the performance part of it, which is what your audience would like to see, probably. So the practicing thing is during the day, so to speak, and then hopefully that will add to my performance.
It won't.
Not directly.
Yeah, practicing doesn't add to performance. Practicing adds to your musical and playing improvement.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like my musical performance, like how I'm playing on stage, not like how I look, or that would be weird, practicing your look on stage.
There's a thing that a lot of people talk about, got to play for the audience, and I have another opposite view. I don't play for the audience. I'm conscious they're there.
Mm-hmm.
I play for me.
Yeah.
And only for me. But I invite you guys to share the experience. So playing beautifully often is a selfish invention. I can't imagine Itzhak Perlman playing the Tchaikovsky concerto, sitting there going, geez, I hope the audience is really digging this. I'll guarantee you that these guys, the greatest musicians, are into their own thing, except that they do something for the audience. That's another thing.
Playing the best they can is mainly for themselves.
For themselves.
Yeah.
But they're not disdaining the audience and they're not ignoring the audience.
No.
They know they're there. So in essence, I've rarely focused on what the audience wants. I'm sure that they're there to be entertained. And if I play well for myself, I think I've given them the entertainment that they deserve. So there's a thing about, you got to make people dance. I mean, if you get two wines in people, they'll dance to Piston. They'll dance to, I'm trying to think of the modern 20th century guys. They'll dance to
basically,
the Bartok. They'll dance to a tractor motor.
People, anyone who's ever visited a wedding knows this.
right on. They'll dance to anything, and that's just the nature of the fun, happy thing of people.
Yeah.
So I've never really been I'm more concerned, if I had one narrow little vision, is to be taught music to play better. Everything else to me is subjective, and I have no opinion about it.
Wow.
It's a personal thing.
I have a question about gear. I posted about this interview on the internet on a couple of places on my Facebook page and on a couple of bass forums online. And if people had any question, there was one which was particularly interesting for me, which I'm going to change a little bit because someone sent me a message asking what your favorite rig of all time is.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
That's what I was coming to. I was guessing that you would go this because this is what I wanted. But if do you remember when you got to a studio or got a new bass, except for these, where you went, I had this experience with this the Dingwall bass I'm playing now. I'm a Fender kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
I told you this beforehand. I'm a Fender kind of guy. I've been playing jazz basses and precision basses all my life, and I played this last year. I was like, well, this is something else. It was unexpected, but it sounds great and it feels great. Do you have a similar experience where you played something or an amp or a pedal that you didn't expect to find as amazing as you thought it would be?
Yes, the ES. This at first, because when I got, actually, I'll start with this. I was in Rome on a gig and I didn't have the amps, you know.
Right.
So the club somehow provided 3-4 different amps to play, and I tried one, tried two, and then I tried a Mark bass. And standing here was a Mark bass rep. I didn't know it at the time. But the minute I actually remember going, whoa, what is this? What was this? And he took note of this and went back to Marco De Virgilis, who's the head of Mark bass, who sent me off a very nice email, would you like to try our amps? And I said, fairly to myself, another company. Yeah, send me an amp, what do I care?
Yeah.
I mean, that was my attitude. He sends me the amp. It was this, not this one, but this model, right out of his assembly line with a tweeter. I plugged it in and I went, what in the world? This is the best sounding gosh darn amp. It had everything I ever envisioned. And I went right to my computer, please let me endorse you. He said, I'll build you anything. I'll build you this, I'll build you that. I said, take this out of your assembly line. Please take out the tweeter. And this is it.
I've
played 50,000, occasionally, not often, but 50,000 seat concerts with two of these, because the PAs are astonishing and the monitors are great. So I'm in a house of bass. It's phenomenal, the tone that comes from behind me and then through the monitors and through the PA. So that's the rig of my heart. Mark bass and the Jeff Berlins and the Players Schools. The Players Schools are a little less powerful. Yeah, it's a 15, but they're way cheaper, and the tone is incredible. I would have done well to having a player's school as well. And, of course, the court bass, because quite frankly, and I'm sorry, I'm going to be this enthusiastic, I think it's the best four-string in the market today. I just do. Plus, you tweak the neck a little.
Yeah.
I filed the frets because I like that. I adjusted the bridge a little bit. And, again, these pickups are only for this model.
Yeah.
So.
But you were going to talk about something other than this rig, something surprising.
Oh yes, I was.
A surprising piece of gear.
I can't remember if it's EBS or ESB. What's the Swedish company?
EBS.
EBS. I was in Holland, and my chorus pedal that I had broke, originally. So I'm at the store. I can't remember. I'm sorry. And the guy says, "Well, put down two or three and make a choice." And then I went through. And each one colored the tone.
Yeah.
So it was chorus, but the bass tone changed. I like the tone to stay the same.
Right.
The color of the tone had changed. Then I went to an EBS, and this roaring, gorgeous chorus sound came out, and I used that. That also killed me because it didn't change the bass tone. And I thought that was a marvelous thing.
They're great pedals.
I agree.
Also, great customer service, by the way.
Are they?
They're
lovely people.
I used to have the gray Octaver pedal. Mm-hmm. They're now black, and it had no pots on it.
Mm.
So I emailed a friend of mine who's a great pedal builder and repair guy, and I said, I have this Octabass. Can you repair it for me? He said, I hope it's not the same I got a few months ago.
It's not an Octabass. Mine was the multi-core.
But mine was the Octaver pedal.
Oh, yours was. Okay.
So I sent it to him, and he sent it right back to me. He's like, I'm not repairing this. This is broken. The PCB is broken. So I went, okay. So I sent it to EBS, and I said, can you guys repair this? They said, yeah, sure. And they sent it back to me with new pots and a new PCB, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was working.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't charge me anything.
Mm.
Great guys. Yeah. So you were talking about... you said very specifically, this is the best four-string passive bass I've ever played since the 1962 Fender. What makes that such a special instrument for you, especially the 1962, which Jaco Pastorius played?
It's coincidentally.
Of course.
I think it's a better bass than the 1962. I think the neck is better. I think it's way better. I play 62s. I've never been fond of the chunkiness of the neck, the frets. It's not a comfortable bass. But as a historical instrument, and because of the tone that it produced, mm-hmm. it's become an icon for the world.
What makes it different for you than a 63 or a 61, especially the 62?
It might be identical, but I'm only aware of the 62, and it seems to be the date that people use.
Yeah.
So I can't honestly say. I researched it to where the 64 sounds worse than the 63, but the 63 sounds better than the 6.
Yeah.
You know, that type of analysis of it. But I would say that window.
Yeah.
Because that is regarded.
The 62 is an icon, of course.
It is an icon, and that's why I refer to it. And this bass, to me, has fair. It doesn't have the same tone.
No.
But it does have an amazing impact.
It has a Fender-ish quality to it.
It does. Somehow. Because I have a bridge pickup, and I have, and again, the sustain, the whole element of it, it's just for me. There's just something brilliant about this bass. That's all I can say.
What made you pick the Babix bridge? The Babix bridge. I had a bass, an ESP bass, in for review for the Bassist, the magazine that we're recording this for.
Yes.
And it also had a Babix bridge, and I never played a bass with one before.
Okay.
And the sustain on it was also incredible. But how did you find out about this particular bridge?
I think I talked to Jeff. He sent me one or put it on, and I was at home.
It's that simple, yeah.
Jeff Babix is a wonderful man. His colleague, Carano, Jeff Carano. And, you know, when we get together, we're Jeffs. Jeff Babix, Jeff Carano, Jeff Berlin. And it's a fun hang. And he's a brilliant builder. I mean, he patented this bridge. It both goes vertical, horizontal, and locks. And he's done unique little things. The alloy is such that, again, the sustain, I could ring one note for a good 30, 40 seconds.
Get yourself a cup of coffee and it's still ringing. Cool. How long are we? An hour? Great. I have one last question, which is I got to ask this, especially for my brother. One of his first major concerts was a duo concert of Michiel Borslap, who's a Dutch bass player, and Bill Bruford, the great drummer that you were also playing with.
Sure.
What's he like?
He's a lovely man, and I owe him a great introduction to the bigger reality of professional music. That was well said, I thought.
That was an amazing sentence.
He showed me what it's like to play. And I was a club bassist. You know, I was a regional guy.
Right.
And when I got with him, when we started to branch out into bigger things, he would comment and offer and things about the studio and things about whatever. And it's part of the self-taught, the autodidactic. It's like I didn't pay for this instruction. It just fell in as a part of my life
growth. Just happened.
Yeah, just happened. And so Bill opened me up to many things. He was a marvelous and an original drummer.
Yes.
I mean, there were guys with, you know, we teased each other about it or joked together.
Yeah.
I mean, he said, I don't have the technique that Cobham does, but he had something where he goes, bing, bang, and it's Bill.
Yeah.
Absolutely instantaneously Bill. That is a brilliant contribution to music, to touch an instrument, especially drums in a sense, an acoustic instrument, and define it as your own.
Yeah.
That, sir, is what originality is. And he did it by experimentation and by the dirt that I mentioned, the being playing badly and fixing it step by step by step.
Yeah.
He's a result of that. And that's why I'm very much for that kind of self-taught version of things rather than school teaching of things. I know I'm reviewing it too much, but let me tell
no
you
problem.
More about what I think.
All right. So,
yeah, Bill is marvelous. I love the man, and I think he's a terrific musician. Very focused, very original, very adventurous, guy. I'll tell you a funny Bill story.
Please do.
He had heavy hands, so he's playing on a piano and he's playing on this piano, good harmony, but just banging away. And one day he plays a chord where this note clashes with this note, and I had referred to my early music training. And said, you know, these two notes don't work together. Because of the, you know.
Yeah.
He looks up very calmly. He goes, yeah, but I like the way it sounds. Pwang! My head exploded. I said, of course. It never occurred to me.
It just sounds good.
So, yeah, I owe a lot to Bill.
That's great.
I like the way it sounds.
I just like it, yeah.
Great. That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. This is a bit like I once asked Marcus Miller at a masterclass he was giving. I said, Marcus, you seem to play an awful lot of themes and melody on your solo albums. Why don't you play the bass line? And he said, it's my album. Uh-huh. I'll do what I want.
Uh-huh.
And that was the answer. I was like, okay, that's true. Jeff, I want to thank you very much for being my guest.
Thanks.
I hope you have a great clinic tonight.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. It's very nice to meet you. Thank you for the chat.
And
thanks, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
You can't see Alex. This is Alex. That's Alex, the world. World Alex.
You heard him. Never seen him. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
You were listening to the interview I had with Jeff Berlin. Did you like this podcast? Subscribe on iTunes and leave a review so people can find the podcast easier. Give me a like on Facebook and check out the official Basgasten playlist on Spotify. In 2 weeks, you'll hear John Stewart from Wilco.
Expel the bull. That was the boss.